Hyperion Audiobooks presents For One More Day. Written and read by Mitch Albom.
Chick Bonetto's first words to me. Let me guess. You want to know why I tried to kill myself? Prologue. This is a story about a family, and as there is a ghost involved, you might call it a ghost story. But every family is a ghost story. The dead sit at our tables long after they have gone. This particular story belongs to Charles Chick Bonetto. He was not the ghost. He was very real. I found him on a Saturday morning in the bleachers of a Little League field, wearing a navy windbreaker and chewing peppermint gum. Maybe you remember him from his baseball days. I've spent part of my career as a sports writer, so the name was familiar to me on several levels. Looking back, it was fate that I found him. I had come to Pepperville Beach to close on a small house that had been in our family for years. On my way back to the airport, I stopped for coffee. There was a field across the street where kids in purple t-shirts were pitching and hitting. I had time. I wandered over. As I stood at the backstop, my fingers curled in the chain-link fence, an old man maneuvered a lawnmower over the grass. He was tanned and wrinkled, with half a cigar in his mouth. He shut the mower when he saw me and asked if I had a kid out there. I said no. He asked what I was doing here. I told him about the house. He asked what I did for a living, and I made the mistake of telling him that too. "A writer, huh?" he said, chewing his cigar. He pointed to a figure sitting alone in the seats with his back to us. "You ought to check out that guy. Now there's a story." I hear this all the time. "Oh yeah, why's that?" "He played pro ball once." "Mm-hmm." "I think he made a World Series." "Mm." "And he tried to kill himself." "What?" "Yeah," the man sniffed. "From what I heard, he's damn lucky to be alive. Chick Bonetto, his name is. His mother used to live around here, Posey Bonetto." He chuckled. "She was wild." He dropped his cigar and stomped on it. "Go on up and ask him if you don't believe me." He returned to his mower. I let go of the batting cage. It was rusty and some of the rust came off of my fingers. Every family is a ghost story. I approached the bleachers. What I have written here is what Charles Chick Bonetto told me in our conversation that morning, which stretched out much longer than that, as well as personal notes and pages from his journal that I found later on my own. I have assembled them into the following narrative in his voice, because I'm not sure you would believe this story if you didn't hear it in his voice. You may not believe it anyhow. But ask yourself this: have you ever lost someone you loved and wanted one more conversation, one more chance to make up for the time when you thought they would be here forever? If so, then you know you can go your whole life collecting days, and none will outweigh the one you wish you had back. What if you got it back? May 2006. Part 1. Midnight. Chick's story. Let me guess. You want to know why I tried to kill myself? You want to know how I survived, why I disappeared, where I've been all this time? But first, why I tried to kill myself, right? It's okay. People do. They measure themselves against me. It's like this line is drawn somewhere in the world, and if you never cross it, you'll never consider throwing yourself off a building or swallowing a bottle of pills. But if you do, you might. People figure I crossed the line. They ask themselves, could I ever get as close as he did? The truth is, there is no line. There's only your life, how you mess it up, and who is there to save you, or who isn't. Looking back, I began to unravel the day my mother died, around 10 years ago. I wasn't there when it happened, and I should have been, so I lied. That was a bad idea. A funeral is no place for secrets. I stood by her gravesite trying to believe it wasn't my fault, And then my 14-year-old daughter took my hand and whispered, "I'm sorry you didn't get a chance to say goodbye, Dad." And that was it. I broke down. I fell to my knees, crying, the wet grass staining my pants. After the funeral, I got so drunk I passed out on our couch. And something changed. One day can bend your life, and that day seemed to bend mine inexorably downward. My mother had been all over me as a kid. Advice, criticism, the whole smothering, mothering thing. There were times I wished she would leave me alone. But then she did. She died. No more visits, no more phone calls. And without even realizing it, I began to drift, as if my roots had been pulled, as if I were floating down some side branch of a river. A buddy once told me, when your parents die, what scares you most is that you're next in line. But for me, it was more than that. Mothers support certain illusions about their children, and one of my illusions was that I liked who I was because she did. When she passed away, so did that idea. The truth is, I didn't like who I was at all. In my mind, I still pictured myself a promising young athlete, but I was no longer young, and I was no longer an athlete. I was a middle-aged salesman. My promise had long since passed. A year after my mother died, I did the dumbest thing I've ever done financially. I let a saleswoman talk me into an investment scheme. She was young and good-looking in that confident, breezy, two-buttons-undone fashion that makes an older man feel bitter when she walks past him, unless, of course, she speaks to him. Then he gets stupid. We met 3 times to discuss the proposal, twice at her office, once in a Greek restaurant. Nothing improper, but by the time her perfume cleared my head, I'd put most of my savings in a now worthless stock fund. She quickly got transferred to the West Coast. I had to explain to my wife, Catherine, where the money went. After that, I drank more. Ballplayers in my time always drank. But it became a problem, which in time got me fired from 2 sales jobs. And getting fired made me keep on drinking. I slept badly. I ate badly. I seemed to be aging while standing still. When I did find work, I hid mouthwash and eye drops in my pockets, darting into bathrooms before meeting clients. Money became a problem. Catherine and I fought constantly about it. And over time, our marriage collapsed. She grew tired of my misery, and I can't say I blame her. When you're rotten about yourself, you become rotten to everyone else, even those you love. One night she found me passed out on the basement floor with my lip cut, cradling a baseball glove. I left my family shortly thereafter, or they left me. I'm more ashamed of that than I can say. I moved to an apartment. I grew ornery and distant. I avoided anyone who wouldn't drink with me. My mother, had she been alive, might have found a way through to me because she was always good at that, taking my arm and saying, "Come on, Charlie, what's the story?" But she wasn't around, and that's the thing when your parents die. You feel like instead of going into every fight with backup, you're going into every fight alone. And one night, in early October, I decided to kill myself. Maybe you're surprised. Maybe you figure men like me, men who play in a World Series, can never sink as low as suicide because they always have, at the very least, that dream came true thing. But you'd be wrong. All that happens when your dream comes true is a slow, melting realization that it wasn't what you thought, and it won't save you. What finished me, what pushed me over the edge, strange as it sounds, was my daughter's wedding. She was 22 now, with long, straight hair, chestnut colored like her mother's, and the same full lips. She married a wonderful guy in an afternoon ceremony. And that's all I know because that's all she wrote in a brief letter which arrived at my apartment a few weeks after the event. Apparently, through my drinking, depression, and generally bad behavior, I had become too great an embarrassment to risk at a family function. Instead, I received that letter and 2 photographs, one of my daughter and her new husband, hands clasped, standing under a tree, the other of the happy couple toasting with champagne. It was the second photo that broke me, one of those candid snapshots that catches a moment never to be repeated, the 2 of them laughing in mid-sentence, tipping their glasses. It was so innocent and so young and so past tense. It seemed to taunt my absence. "And you weren't there." I didn't even know this guy. My ex-wife did, our old friends did, and you weren't there. Once again, I had been absent from a critical family moment. This time, my little girl would not take my hand and comfort me. She belonged to someone else now. I was not being asked. I was being notified. I looked at the envelope, which carried her new last name, Maria Lang, not Maria Bonetto, and no return address. Why, were they afraid I might visit them? And something sunk so low inside me I couldn't find it anymore. You get shut out of your only child's life. You feel like a steel door has been locked. You're banging, but they just can't hear you. And being unheard is the ground floor of giving up, and giving up is the ground floor of doing yourself in. So I tried to. It's not so much, what's the point? It's more like, what's the difference? When he went blundering back to God, his songs half written, his work half done, who knows what paths his bruised feet trod, what hills of peace or pain he won. I hope God smiled and took his hand and said, poor truant, passionate fool, life's book is hard to understand. Why couldst thou not remain at school? A poem by Charles Hanson Towne, found inside a notebook amongst Chick Bonetto's belongings. Chick tries to end it all. That letter from my daughter arrived on a Friday, which conveniently allowed for a weekend bender, not much of which I remember. Monday morning, despite a long cold shower, I was 2 hours late for work. When I got to the office, I lasted less than 45 minutes. My head was throbbing. The place felt like a tomb. I slid into the Xerox room, then the bathroom, then the elevator, without a coat or a briefcase, so that if someone were charting my movements, they would seem normal and not an orchestrated exit. That was stupid. No one cared. This was a big company with lots of salespeople, and it could survive just fine without me, as we now know, since that walk from the elevator to the parking lot was my last act as an employee. Next, I called my ex-wife. I called from a payphone. She was at work. Why? I said when she answered. Chick? Why? I repeated. I'd had 3 days to lather up my anger, and that was all that came out. One word. Why? Chick, her tone softened. I wasn't even invited? It was their idea. They thought it was, what, safer? I was going to do something? I don't know. I'm a monster now? Is that it? Where are you? I'm a monster? Stop. I'm leaving. Look, Chick, she's not a kid anymore. And if you couldn't stand up for me? I heard her exhale. Leaving where? She said. You couldn't stand up for me? I'm sorry. It's complicated. There's his family, too, and they... Did you go with someone? Oh, Chick, I'm at work, okay? At that moment, I felt lonelier than I'd ever felt before, and that loneliness seemed to squat in my lungs and crush all but my most minimal breathing. There was nothing left to say. Not about this. Not about anything. It's all right, I whispered. I'm sorry. There was a pause. Leaving where? She said. I hung up. And then, for the last time, I got drunk. First at a place called Mr. Ted's Pub, where the bartender was a skinny, round-faced kid, probably no older than the guy my daughter married. Later, I went back to my apartment and drank some more. I knocked over furniture. I wrote on the walls. I think I actually stuffed the wedding photos down the garbage disposal. Somewhere in the middle of the night, I decided to go home, meaning Pepperville Beach, the town where I grew up. It was 2 hours away by car, but I hadn't been there in years. I moved around my apartment, walking in circles as if preparing for the journey. You don't need much for a goodbye trip. I went to the bedroom and took a gun out of the drawer. I stumbled down to the garage, found my car, put the gun in the glove compartment, threw a jacket in the back seat, maybe the front seat, or maybe the jacket was already there, I don't know, and I screeched into the street. The city was quiet, the lights were blinking yellow, and I was going to end my life where I began it. Blundering back to God. Simple as that. Birth announcement from Chick Bonetto's papers. We are proud to announce the birth of Charles Alexander 8 pounds, 11 ounces, November 21st, 1949, Leonard and Pauline Bonetto. It was cold and raining lightly, but the highway, thankfully, was pretty empty, and I used every one of its four lanes weaving back and forth. You would think, you would hope, that someone as lit as I was would be stopped by the police, but I wasn't. At one point, I even rolled into one of those all-night convenience stores, and I bought a six-pack of beer from an Asian guy with a thin mustache. "Lottery ticket?" he asked. I had, over the years, perfected a functional appearance when I was smashed, the alcoholic as walking man, and I pretended to give the question some thought. "Not this time," I said. He put the beer in a bag. I caught his gaze, two dull, dark eyes, and I thought to myself, "Okay, this is the last face I will see on Earth." He pushed my change across the counter. By the time I saw the sign for my hometown, Pepperville Beach, exit 1 mile, two of the beers were gone and one had spilled all over the passenger seat. The wipers were thumping. I was fighting to stay awake. I must have tranced out thinking, "Exit 1 mile," because after a while I saw a sign for another town and realized I had missed my turn off altogether. I banged on the dashboard. Then I spun the car around right there in the middle of the highway and drove back in the wrong direction. There was no traffic and I wouldn't have cared anyhow. I was getting to that exit. I slammed the accelerator. Quickly enough, a ramp came into view, the on-ramp, not the exit ramp, and I screeched toward it. It was one of those long, twisting things, and I held the wheel in a locked turn, going fast around and down. Suddenly, two huge lights blinded me like two giant suns. Then a truck horn blasted, then a jolting smash. Then my car flew over an embankment and landed hard, thumping downhill. There was glass everywhere and beer cans bouncing around, and I grabbed wildly at the steering wheel and the car jerked backward, flipping me onto my stomach. I somehow found the door handle and yanked it hard, and I remember flashes of black sky and green weeds and a sound like thunder and something high and solid crashing down. When I opened my eyes, I was lying in wet grass. My car was half buried under a billboard for a local Chevrolet dealership into which it had apparently plowed. In one of those freak moments of physics, I must have been thrown from the vehicle before its final impact. I can't explain it. When you want to die, you're spared. Who can explain that? I slowly, painfully got to my feet. My back was soaked. I ached all over. It was still raining lightly, but it was quiet, save for the sound of crickets. Normally, at this point, you'd say, "I was just happy to be alive." But I can't say that, because I wasn't. I looked up at the highway. In the mist, I could make out the truck, like a big, hulking shipwreck. The front cab bent as if its neck had been snapped. Steam rose from the hood. One headlamp was still working, casting a lonely beam down the muddy hill that made twinkling diamonds out of the shattered glass. Where was the driver? Was he alive, hurt, bleeding, breathing? The courageous thing, of course, would have been to climb up and check. But courage was not my strong suit at that moment. So I didn't. Instead, I put my hands down flat by my sides and turned south, walking back toward my old town. I'm not proud of this, but I was not in any way rational at that moment. I was a zombie, a robot, devoid of concern for anyone, myself included, myself actually at the top of the list. I forgot about the car, the truck, the gun. I left it all behind. My shoes crunched on the gravel, and I heard the crickets laughing. I can't say how long I walked. Long enough that the rain stopped and the sky began to lighten with the first stirrings of dawn. I reached the outskirts of Pepperville Beach, which was marked by a big rusty water tower just behind the baseball fields. In small towns like mine, climbing water towers was a rite of passage, and my baseball buddies and I used to climb this one on weekends, the spray paint cans jammed in our waistbands. Now I stood before that water tower again, wet and old and broken and drunk and perhaps a killer, I should add, or so I suspected, because I never did see the driver of the truck. It didn't matter, because my next act was a no-brainer, as determined as I was to make this the last night of my life. I found the ladder's bottom. I began to climb. It took me a while to reach the riveted tank. When I finally did, I collapsed on the catwalk, breathing hard, sucking air. In the back of my addled brain, a voice scolded me for being so out of shape. I looked out on the trees below me. Behind them, I saw the baseball field where I had learned the game from my father. The sight of it still dredged up sad memories. What is it about childhood that never lets you go, even when you're so wrecked it's hard to believe you ever were a child? The sky was lightening. The crickets grew louder. I had a sudden memory flash of little Maria asleep on my chest when she was small enough to cradle in one arm, her skin smelling of talcum powder. Then I had a vision of me, wet and filthy as I was now, bursting into her wedding, the music stopping, everyone looking up, horrified. Maria, the most horrified of all. I lowered my head. I would not be missed. I took two running steps, grabbed the railing, and hurled myself over. The rest is inexplicable. What I hit, how I survived, I cannot tell you. All I recall is twisting and snapping and brushing and flipping and scraping and a final thud. These scars on my face, I figure they came from that. It seemed as if I fell for a very long time. When I opened my eyes, I was surrounded by fallen pieces of the tree. Stones pressed into my stomach and chest. I lifted my chin, and this is what I saw. The baseball field of my youth, coming into the morning light, the two dugouts, the pitcher's mound, and my mother, who had been dead for years. Part 2. Mourning. Chick's mom. My father once told me, you can be a mama's boy or a daddy's boy, but you can't be both. So I was a daddy's boy. I mimicked his walk. I mimicked his deep, smoky laugh. I carried a baseball glove because he loved baseball, and I took every hard ball he threw, even the ones that stung my hand so badly I thought I would scream. When school was out, I would run to his liquor store on Craft Avenue and stay until dinner time, playing with empty boxes in the storeroom, waiting for him to finish. We would ride home together in his sky-blue Buick sedan, and sometimes we would sit in the driveway as he smoked his Chesterfields and listened to the radio news. I have a younger sister named Roberta, and back then she wore pink ballerina slippers almost everywhere. When we ate at the local diner, my mother would yank her to the ladies' room, her pink feet sliding across the tile, while my father took me to the gents. In my young mind, I figured this was life's assignment, me with him, her with her, ladies, gents, mamas, daddies, a daddy's boy. I was a daddy's boy, and I remained a daddy's boy, right up to a hot, cloudless Saturday morning in the spring of my fifth grade year. We had a doubleheader scheduled that day against the Cardinals, who wore red wool uniforms and were sponsored by Connor's Plumbing Supply. The sun was already warming the kitchen when I entered in my long socks, carrying my glove, and saw my mother at the table smoking her cigarette. My mother was a beautiful woman, but she didn't look beautiful that morning. She bit her lip and looked away from me. I remember the smell of burnt toast, and I thought she was upset because she messed up breakfast. "I'll eat cereal," I said. I took a bowl from the cupboard. She cleared her throat. "What time is your game, honey?" "Do you have a cold?" I asked. She shook her head and put a hand to her cheek. "What time is your game?" "I don't know." I shrugged. This was before I wore a watch. I got the glass bottle of milk and the big box of corn puffs. I poured the corn puffs too fast, and some bounced out of the bowl and onto the table. My mother picked them up, one at a time, and put them in her palm. "I'll take you," she whispered, "whenever it is." "Why can't Daddy take me?" I asked. "Daddy's not here." "Where is he?" She didn't answer. "When's he coming back?" She squeezed the corn puffs, and they crumbled into floury dust. I was a mama's boy from that day on. Now, when I say I saw my dead mother, I mean just that. I saw her. She was standing by the dugout, wearing a lavender jacket, holding her pocketbook. She didn't say a word. She just looked at me. I tried to lift myself in her direction, then fell back, a bolt of pain shooting through my muscles. My brain wanted to shout her name, but there was no sound from my throat. I lowered my head and put my palms together. I pushed hard again, and this time I lifted myself halfway off the ground. I looked up. She was gone. I don't expect you to go with me here. It's crazy, I know. You don't see dead people. You don't get visits. You don't fall off a water tower, miraculously alive, despite your best attempt to kill yourself, and see your dearly departed mother holding her pocketbook on the third base line. I've given it all the thought that you're probably giving it right now. A hallucination, a fantasy, a drunken dream, the mixed-up brain on its mixed-up way. As I say, I don't expect you to go with me here. But this is what happened. She had been there. I had seen her. I lay in the field for an indeterminate amount of time, then I dragged myself to a standing position, and I got myself walking. I brushed the sand and debris from my knees and forearms. I was bleeding from dozens of cuts, most of them small, a few bigger. I could taste blood in my mouth. I cut across a familiar patch of grass. The morning wind shook the trees and brought a sweep of yellow leaves like a small fluttering rainstorm. I had twice failed to kill myself. How pathetic was that? I headed toward my old house, determined to finish the job. A note from Chick Veneto's papers, circa 1954. Dear Charlie, have lots of fun in school today. I will see you at lunchtime, and we'll get a milkshake. I love you every day. Mom. How Mother Met Father. My mother was always writing me notes. She slipped them to me whenever she dropped me off somewhere. I never understood this, since anything she had to say she could have said right then and saved herself the paper and the awful taste of envelope glue. I think the first note was on my first day of kindergarten in 1954. What was I, 5 years old? The schoolyard was filled with kids shrieking and running around. We approached, me holding my mother's hand, as a woman in a black beret formed lines in front of the teachers. I saw the other mothers kissing their kids and walking away. I must have started crying. What's the matter? My mother asked. Don't go. I'll be here when you come out. No, it's okay. I'll be here. What if I can't find you? You will. What if I lose you? You can't lose your mother, Charlie. She smiled. She reached inside her jacket pocket and handed me a small blue envelope. Here, she said. If you miss me really badly, you can open this. She wiped my eyes with a tissue from her purse, then hugged me goodbye. I could still see her walking backward, blowing me kisses, her lips painted in red Revlon, her hair swept up above her ears. I waved goodbye with the letter. It didn't occur to her, I guess, that I was just starting school and didn't know how to read. That was my mother. It was the thought that counted. She met my father, the story goes, down by Pepperville Lake in the spring of 1944. She was swimming, and he was throwing a baseball with his friend, and his friend whipped it too high, and it landed in the water. My mother swam to get it. My father splashed in. As he surfaced with the ball, they banged heads. And we never stopped, she would say. They had a fast, intense courtship because that's how my father was. He started things with an aim to finish them. He was a tall, meaty young man, fresh out of high school, who combed his hair in a high pompadour, and drove his father's blue and white LaSalle. He enlisted in World War II as soon as he could, telling my mother he'd like to kill more of the enemy than anyone in our town. He was shipped overseas to Italy, the northern Apennine Mountains and the Po Valley near Bologna. In a letter from there in 1945, he proposed to my mother. "Be my wife," he wrote, which sounded more like a command to me. My mother agreed in a return letter she wrote on special linen stationery, which was too expensive for her, but which she bought anyhow, my mother being respectful of both words and the vehicle used to deliver them. 2 weeks after my father received it, the Germans signed the surrender documents. He was coming home. My theory was he never got enough war for his liking, so he made his own with us. My father's name was Leonard, but everyone called him Len, and my mother's name was Pauline, but everyone called her Posy, like the nursery rhyme, A Pocket Full of Posy. She had large almond-shaped eyes, dark sweeping hair that she often wore up, and a soft, creamy complexion. She reminded people of the actress Audrey Hepburn, and in our small town, there weren't many women who fit that description. She loved wearing makeup, mascara, eyeliner, rouge, you name it. And while most people considered her fun or perky or later eccentric or headstrong, for most of my childhood, I considered her a nag. Was I wearing my galoshes? Did I have my jacket? Did I finish my schoolwork? Why were my pants ripped? She was always correcting my grammar. "Me and Roberta are gonna," I'd start. "Roberta and I," she would interrupt. "Me and Jimmy want to," "Jimmy and I," she would say. Parents slot into postures in a child's mind, and my mother's posture was a lipsticked woman leaning over, wagging a finger, imploring me to be better than I was. My father's posture was a man in repose, shoulders pressed against a wall, holding a cigarette, watching me sink or swim. In retrospect, I should have made more of the fact that one was leaning toward me and the other was leaning away. But I was a kid, and what do kids know? My mother was French Protestant and my father was Italian Catholic, and their union was an excess of God, guilt, and sauce. They argued all the time, the kids, food, religion. My father would hang a picture of Jesus on the wall outside the bathroom, and while he was at work, my mother would move it somewhere less conspicuous. He would come home and yell, "You can't move Jesus, for Christ's sake!" And she would say, "It's a picture, Len. You think God wants to hang by the bathroom?" And he would put it back, and the next day she would move it. On and on like that. They were a blend of backgrounds and cultures, but if my family was a democracy, my father's vote counted twice. He decided what we should eat for dinner, what color to paint the house, what bank we should use, which channel we watched on our Zenith console black and white TV set. On the day I was born, he informed my mother, "The kid is getting baptized in the Catholic Church." And that was that. The funny thing is, he wasn't religious himself. After the war, my father, who owned a liquor store, was more interested in prophets than prophecies. And when it came to me, the only thing I had to worship was baseball. He was pitching to me before I could walk. He gave me a wooden bat before my mother let me use scissors. He said I could make the major leagues one day if I had a plan and if I stuck to the plan. Of course, when you're that young, you nest in your parents' plans, not your own. And so, from the time I was 7 years old, I scanned the newspaper for the box scores of my future employers. I kept a glove at my father's liquor store in case he could steal a few minutes and throw to me in the parking lot. I even wore cleats to Sunday Mass sometimes because we left for American Legion games right after the final hymn. When they referred to the church as God's house, I worried that the Lord did not appreciate my spikes digging into his floors. I tried standing on my toes once, but my father whispered, "What the hell are you doing?" And I lowered myself quickly. My mother, on the other hand, didn't care for baseball. She'd been an only child, her family had been poor, and she'd had to drop out of school to work during the war. She earned her high school diploma at night and did nursing school after that. In her mind, for me, there were only books and college and the gates they would open. The best she could say about baseball was that it gets you some fresh air. But she showed up. She sat in the stands wearing her big sunglasses, her hair always well coiffed, courtesy of the local beauty parlor. Sometimes I would peek at her from inside the dugout, and she'd be looking off over the horizon. But when I came to bat, she took off her glasses and she clapped and yelled, "Yay, Charlie!" And I guess that's all I cared about. My father, who coached every team I played on up to the day he split, once caught me looking her way and hollered, "Eyes on the ball, chick! There's nothing up there that's going to help you!" Mom, I guess, wasn't part of the plan. Still, I can say I adored my mother in the way that boys adore their mothers while taking them for granted. She made that easy. For one thing, she was funny. She didn't mind smearing ice cream on her face for a laugh. She did odd voices like Popeye the Sailor Man or Louis Armstrong croaking, "If you ain't got it in you, you can't blow it out, cha-cha-cha-cha." She tickled me and she let me tickle her back, squeezing her elbows in as she laughed. She tucked me in at night, rubbing my hair and saying, "Give your mother a kiss." She told me I was smart and that being smart was a privilege, and she insisted that I read one book every week and took me to the library to make sure this happened. She dressed too flashy sometimes, which bothered me, and she sang along with our music, which bothered me too, but there was never, not for a moment, a question of trust between us. If my mother said it, I believed it. She wasn't easy on me, don't get me wrong. She smacked me, she scolded me, she punished me. But she loved me. She really did. She loved me falling off a swing set. She loved me stepping on her floors with muddy shoes. She loved me through vomit and snot and bloody knees. She loved me coming and going at my worst and at my best. She had a bottomless well of love for me. Her only flaw was that she didn't make me work for it. You see, here's my theory. Kids chase the love that eludes them, and for me, that was my father's love. He kept it tucked away like papers in a briefcase, and I kept trying to get in there. Years later, after her death, I made lists of the times my mother stood up for me and the times I did not stand up for my mother. It was sad, the imbalance of it all. Why do kids assume so much from one parent and hold the other to a lower, looser standard? Maybe it's like my old man said, you can be a mama's boy or a daddy's boy, but you can't be both. So you cling to the one you think you might lose. Times my mother stood up for me. I'm 5 years old. We are walking to Finelli's Market. A neighbor in a bathrobe and pink curlers opens her screen door and calls to my mother. As they talk, I wander to the backyard of the house next door. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a German shepherd lunges at me. Ow, wow, wow, wow! It is tethered to a clothesline. Ow, wow, wow, wow! It rises on its hind legs, straining the leash. Ow, wow, wow, wow! I whirl and run. I'm screaming. My mother dashes to me. What? She hollers, grabbing my elbows. What is it? A dog! She exhales. A dog? Where? Around there? I nod, crying. She marches me around the house. There is the dog. It howls again. Ow, wow, wow, wow! I jump back. But my mother yanks me forward, and she barks. She barks. She makes the best barking sound I have ever heard a human being make. The dog falls into a whimpering crouch. My mother turns. You have to show them who's boss, Charlie, she says. Chick returns to his old house. By now, the morning sun was just over the horizon, and it came at me like a sidearm pitch between the houses of my old neighborhood. I shielded my eyes. My head was throbbing. This being early October, there were already piles of leaves pushed against the curb, more leaves than I remembered from my autumns here, and less open space in the sky. I think what you notice most when you haven't been home in a while is how much the trees have grown around your memories. Pepperville Beach. Do you know how it got its name? It's almost embarrassing. A small patch of sand had been trucked in years ago by some entrepreneur who thought the town would be more impressive if we had a beach, even though we didn't have an ocean. He joined the Chamber of Commerce, and he even got the town's name changed. Pepperville Lake became Pepperville Beach, despite the fact that our beach had a swing set and a sliding board and was big enough for about 12 families before you'd be sitting on someone else's towel. It became sort of a joke when we were growing up. Hey, you want to go to the beach? Or, hey, it looks like a beach day to me. Because we knew we weren't fooling anybody. Anyhow, our house was near the lake and the beach, and my sister and I had kept it after our mother died because I guess we hoped it might be worth something someday. To be honest, I didn't have the stomach to sell it. Now I walked toward that house with my back hunched like a fugitive. I had left the scene of an accident, and surely someone had discovered the car, the truck, the smashed billboard, the gun. I was aching, bleeding, still half dazed. I expected to hear police sirens at any moment. All the more reason I should kill myself first. I staggered up the porch steps. I found the key we kept hidden under a phony rock in a flower box, my sister's idea. Looking over both shoulders, seeing nothing, no police, no people, not a single car coming from either direction, I pushed the door open and went inside. The house was musty, and there was a faint sweet smell of carpet cleaner, as if someone, maybe the caretaker we paid, had recently shampooed it. I stepped past the hallway closet and the banister we used to slide down as kids. I entered the kitchen with its old tile floor and its cherry wood cabinets. I opened the refrigerator because I was looking for something alcoholic. By now, this was a reflex with me. And I stepped back. There was food inside. Tupperware, leftover lasagna, skim milk, apple juice, raspberry yogurt. For a fleeting moment, I wondered if someone had moved in, a squatter of some kind, and this was now his place, the price we paid for ignoring it for so long. I opened a cabinet. There was Lipton tea and a bottle of Sanka. I opened another cabinet, sugar, Morton salt, paprika, oregano. I saw a dish in the sink, soaking under bubbles. I lifted it and slowly lowered it as if trying to put it back in place. And then I heard something. It came from upstairs. Charlie? Again. Charlie? It was my mother's voice. I ran out the kitchen door, my fingers wet with soapy water. Times I did not stand up for my mother. I am 6 years old. It is Halloween. The school is having its annual Halloween parade. All the kids will march a few blocks through the neighborhood. Just buy them a costume, my father says. They have them at the Five and Dime. But no, my mother decides, since this is my first parade, she will make me a costume. The mummy, my favorite scary character. She cuts up white rags and old towels and wraps them around me, holding them in place with safety pins. Then she layers the rags with toilet paper and tape. It takes a long time, but when she's finished, I look in the mirror. I am a mummy. I lift my shoulders and sway back and forth. "Ooh, you're very scary," my mother says. She drives me to school. We start our parade. The more I walk, the looser the rags get. Then about two blocks out, it begins to rain. Next thing I know, the toilet paper is dissolving. The rags droop. Soon they fall to my ankles, wrists, and neck, and you can see my undershirt and pajama bottoms, which my mother thought would make better undergarments. "Look at Charlie!" the other kids squeal. They are laughing. I'm burning red. I want to disappear, but where do you go in the middle of a parade? When we reach the schoolyard, where the parents are waiting with cameras, I'm a wet, sagging mess of rags and toilet paper fragments. I see my mother first. As she spots me, she raises her hand to her mouth. I burst into tears. "You ruined my life!" I yell. "Charlie?" What I remember most, hiding on that back porch, is how fast my breath left me. One second I had been at the refrigerator, dragging through the motions. The next second my heart was racing so fast I thought no amount of oxygen could sustain it. I was shaking. The kitchen window was at my back, but I didn't dare look through it. I had seen my dead mother, and now I had heard her voice. I had broken parts of my body before, but this was the first time I worried I had damaged my mind. I stood there, my lungs heaving in and out, my eyes locked on the earth in front of me. As kids, we'd call this our backyard, but it was just a square of grass. I thought about bounding across it to a neighbor's house. And then the door opened. And my mother stepped outside. My mother, right there, on that porch. And she turned to me. And she said, "What are you doing out here? It's cold." Now, I don't know if I can explain the leap I made. It's like jumping off the planet. There's everything you know, and there is everything that happens. When the two do not line up, you make a choice. I saw my mother, alive, in front of me. I heard her say my name again. Charlie? She was the only one who ever called me that. Was I hallucinating? Should I move toward her? Was she like a bubble that would burst? Honestly, at this point, my limbs seemed to belong to someone else. "Charlie, what's the matter? You're all cut." She was wearing blue slacks and a white sweater now. She was always dressed, it seemed, no matter how early in the morning. And she looked to be no older than the last time I had seen her, on her 79th birthday, wearing those red-rimmed glasses she got as a present. She turned her palms gently upward, and she beckoned me with her eyes and, I don't know, those glasses, her skin, her hair, her opening the back door the way she used to when I threw tennis balls off the roof of our house. Something melted inside of me, as if her face gave off heat. It went down my back, went to my ankles, and then something broke. I almost heard the snap, the barrier between belief and disbelief. I gave in, off the planet. "Charlie," she said, "what's wrong?" I did what you would have done. I hugged my mother as if I'd never let her go. Times my mother stood up for me. I am 8 years old. I have a homework assignment. I must recite to the class, "What causes an echo?" At the liquor store after school, I asked my father, "What causes an echo?" He is bent over in the aisle, checking inventory with a clipboard and a pencil. "I don't know, chick. It's like a ricochet." "Doesn't it happen in the mountains?" "Hmm?" he says, counting bottles. "Weren't you in the mountains in the war?" He shoots me a look. "What are you asking about that for?" He returns to his clipboard. That night I asked my mother, She gets the dictionary and we sit in the den. "Let him do it himself," my father snaps. "Len," she says, "I'm allowed to help him." For an hour, she works with me. I practice by standing in front of her. "What causes an echo?" she begins. "The persistence of sound after the source has stopped," I say. "What is the one thing required for an echo?" "The sound must bounce off something." "When can you hear an echo?" "When it's quiet and other sounds are absorbed." She smiles. "Good." Then she says, "Echo," and covers her mouth and mumbles, "Echo, echo, echo." My sister, who has been watching our performance, points and yells, "That's Mommy talking, I see her." My father turns on the TV set. "What a colossal waste of time," he says. The melody changes. Do you remember that song, "This Could Be the Start of Something Big"? It was a fast, upbeat tune, usually sung by a guy in a tuxedo in front of a big band. My mother loved that song, don't ask me why. They played it at the start of the Steve Allen Show back in the 50s, which I recall as a black and white program, although everything seemed to be in black and white in those days. Anyhow, my mother thought that song was a swinger. That's what she called it. "Ooh, that one's a swinger." And whenever it came on the radio, she snapped her fingers like she was leading the band. We had a hi-fi, and one year for her birthday, she got an album by Bobby Darin. He sang that tune, and she played the record after dinner as she cleaned the dishes. This was when my dad was still in the picture. He'd be reading his newspaper, and she would walk over to him and drum on his shoulder, singing, "This could be the start of something big." And of course, he wouldn't even look up. Then she'd come over to me and make like she was playing drumsticks on my chest as she sang along. I wanted to laugh, but since my father wasn't participating, laughter felt like a betrayal. Then my mother started tickling me, and I couldn't help it. "This could be the start of something big," she'd say. "Big boy, big boy, big boy, big boy, big, 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 big boy." She used to play that music every night. But once my father left, she never did again. The Bobby Darin album stayed on the shelf. The record player collected dust. At first, I thought she had changed her taste in music the way we did as kids, at one point thinking Johnny Ray was a good singer, but eventually thinking Gene Vincent was so much better. Later, I figured she didn't want to be reminded of how the something big had backfired. The encounter inside the house. Our kitchen table was round and made of oak. One afternoon, when we were in grade school, my sister and I carved our names in it with steak knives. We hadn't finished when we heard the door open. Our mother was home from work, so we threw the steak knives back in the drawer. My sister grabbed the biggest thing she could find, a half gallon of apple juice, and plopped it down. When my mother entered, wearing her nurse's outfit, her arms full of magazines, we must have said, "Hi, Mom," too quickly, because she immediately became suspicious. You can see that in your mother's face right away, that "what did you kids do" look. Maybe because we were sitting at an otherwise empty table at 5:30 in the afternoon with a half gallon of apple juice between us. Anyhow, without letting go of her magazine, she nudged the juice aside and saw Char and Rober, which was as far as we got, and she let out a loud, exasperated sound, something like, "Ugh!" Then she screamed, "Great, just great!" And in my childish mind, I thought maybe it wasn't so bad. Great was great, right? My father was traveling in those days, and my mother threatened his wrath when he got home. But that night, as we sat at the table eating a meatloaf with a hard-boiled egg inside it, a recipe she had read somewhere, perhaps in one of those magazines she carried, my sister and I kept glancing at our work. "You know you've completely ruined this table," my mother said. "Sorry," we mumbled. "And you could have cut your fingers off with those knives." We sat there admonished, lowering our heads to the obligatory level for penance. But we were both thinking the same thing. Only my sister said it. "Should we finish so at least we spell our names right?" I stopped breathing for a moment, astonished at her courage. My mother shot her a dagger-like stare. Then she burst out laughing, and my sister burst out laughing, and I spit out a mouthful of meatloaf. We never finished the names. They remained there always as Char and Rober. My father, of course, blew a gasket when he got home. But I think over the years, long after we departed Pepperville Beach, my mother came to like the idea that we had left something behind, even if we were a few letters short. Now I sat at that old kitchen table, and I saw those markings, and then my mother, or her ghost, or whatever she was, came in from the other room with an antiseptic bottle and a washcloth. I watched her pour the antiseptic into the fabric, then reach for my arm and push up my shirt sleeve, as if I were a little boy who had fallen off the swing set. Perhaps you're thinking, why not scream out the absurdity of the situation, the obvious facts that made this all impossible, the first of which is, Mother, you died. I can only answer by saying it makes sense to me now as it makes sense to you now, in the retelling, but not in that moment. In that moment, I was so stunned by seeing my mother again that correcting it seemed impossible. It was dreamlike, and maybe part of me felt I was dreaming. I don't know. If you've lost your mother, can you imagine seeing her right in front of you again, close enough to touch, to smell? I knew we had buried her. I remembered the funeral. I remembered shoveling a symbolic pile of dirt on her coffin. But when she sat down across from me and dabbed the washcloth on my face and arms, and she grimaced at the cuts and mumbled, "Look at you," I don't know how to say it. It burst through my defenses. It had been a long time since anyone wanted to be that close to me, to show the tenderness it took to roll up a shirt sleeve. She cared. She gave a crap. When I lacked even the self-respect to keep myself alive, she dabbed my cuts, and I fell back into being a son. I fell as easily as you fall into your pillow at night, and I didn't want it to end. That's the best way I can explain it. I knew it was impossible, but I didn't want it to end. "Mom," I whispered. I hadn't said it in so long. When death takes your mother, it steals that word forever. "Mom?" It's just a sound, really, a hum interrupted by open lips. But there are a zillion words on this planet, and not one of them comes out of your mouth the way that one does. "Mom?" She wiped my arm gently with the washcloth. "Charlie," she sighed, "the trouble you get into." Times my mother stood up for me. I'm 9 years old. I'm at the local library. The woman behind the desk looks over her glasses. I have chosen 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne. I like the drawings on the cover, and I like the idea of people living under the ocean. I haven't looked at how big the words are or how narrow the print. The librarian studies me. My shirt is untucked and one shoe is untied. "This is too hard for you," she says. I watch her put it on a shelf behind her. Might as well be locked in a vault. I go back to the children's section and choose a picture book about a monkey. I return to the desk. She stamps this one without comment. When my mother drives up, I scramble into the front seat of her car. She sees the book I've chosen. "Haven't you read that one already?" she says. "The lady wouldn't let me take the one I wanted." "What lady?" "The librarian lady." She turns off the ignition. "Why wouldn't she let you take it?" "She said it was too hard." "What was too hard?" "The book." My mother yanks me from the car. She marches me through the door and up to the desk. "I'm Mrs. Bonetto. This is my son, Charlie. Did you tell him a book was too hard for him to read?" The librarian stiffens. She's much older than my mother, and I'm surprised at my mother's tone, given how she usually talks to old people. "He wanted to take out 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne," she says, touching her glasses. "He's too young. Look at him." I lower my head. "Look at me." "Where's the book?" my mother says. "I beg your pardon. Where's the book?" The woman reaches behind her. She plops it on the counter as if to make a point by its heft. My mother grabs the book and shoves it in my arms. "Don't you ever tell a child something's too hard," she snaps. "And never, never this child." Next thing I know, I'm being yanked out the door, hanging tightly to Jules Verne. I feel like we have just robbed a bank, my mother and me, and I wonder if we're going to get in trouble. Times I did not stand up for my mother. We were at the table. My mother is serving dinner, baked ziti with meat sauce. "Still not right," my father says. "Not again," my mother says. "Not again," my little sister mimics. She rolls her fork in her mouth. "Watch, you'll stick yourself," my mother says, pulling my sister's hand away. "It's something with the cheese or the oil," my father says, looking at his food as if it disgusts him. I've tried 10 different ways, my mother says. Don't exaggerate, Posey. Is it such a big deal to make something I can eat? You can't eat it? It's inedible now? Jesus, he groans. Do I need this? My mother stops looking at him. No, you don't need it, she says, scooping a portion angrily into my plate. But I need it, right? I need an argument. Eat, Charlie. Not so much, I say. Eat what I give you, she snaps. It's too much. Mommy, my sister says. All I'm saying, Posey, is if I ask you to do it, you can do it. That's all. I told you a million times why it don't taste right. If it ain't right, it ain't right. You want me to lie to make you happy? Mommy, my sister says. She's waving her fork. Ah, my mother gasps, lowering my sister's fork. Stop that, Roberta. You know what, Len? Make it yourself next time. You and this whole Italian cooking thing. Charlie, eat. My father sneers and shakes his head. Same old story, he grouses. I'm watching him. He sees me. I quickly put a forkful in my mouth. He motions with his chin. What do you think of the ziti your mother made? He says. I chew. I swallow. I look at him. I look at my mother. She drops her shoulders in exasperation. Now they're both waiting. It's not right, I mumble, looking at my father. He snorts and shoots my mother a look. Even the kid knows, he says. A fresh start. So, can you stay all day? My mother asked. She was standing over the range, scrambling eggs with a plastic spatula. Toast had already been popped, and a stick of butter sat on the table. A pot of coffee was alongside it. I slumped there, still dazed, having trouble even swallowing. I felt that if I moved too quickly, everything would burst. She had tied an apron around her waist and had acted, in the minutes since I first saw her, as if this were just another day, as if I had surprised her with a visit, and in return, she was cooking me breakfast. "Can you, Charlie?" she said. "Spend a day with your mother?" I heard the sizzling of butter and eggs. "Hmm?" she said. She lifted the fry pan and approached. "Why so quiet?" It took a few seconds to find my voice, as if I were remembering instructions on how to do it. How do you talk to the dead? Is there another set of words? A secret code? "Mom," I finally whispered, "this is impossible." She scooped the eggs from the pan and chop, chop, chop them on my plate. I watched her veined hands work the spatula. "Eat," she said. At some point in American history, things must have changed, and divorcing parents informed their children as a team, sat them down, explained the new rules. My family collapsed before that age of enlightenment. When my father was gone, he was gone. After a few weepy days, my mother put on lipstick, did her eyes with mascara, cooked up some fried potatoes, and said as she handed us our plates, "Dad isn't going to live here anymore." And that was that. It was like a set change in a play. I can't even remember when he got his stuff. One day we came home from school and the house just seemed more roomy. There was extra space in the front hall closet. The garage was missing tools and boxes. I remember my sister crying and asking, "Did I make Daddy go away?" and promising my mother that she would behave better if he came home. I remember wanting to cry myself, but it had already dawned on me that there were now three of us, not four, and I was the only male. Even at 11, I felt an obligation to manhood. Besides, my father used to tell me to buck up whenever I cried. "Buck up, kid, buck up." And like all children whose parents split, I was trying to behave in a way that would bring the missing one back. So no tears, chick. Not for you. For the first few months, we figured it was temporary. A spat, a cooling off period. Parents fight, right? Ours did. My sister and I would lie at the top of the staircase listening to their arguments, me in my white undershirt and she in her pale yellow pajamas and ballerina slippers. Sometimes they argued about us. "Why don't you handle it for once, Len?" "It's not that big a deal." "Yes, it is, and I'm always the witch who has to tell them." Or about work. "You could pay more attention, Posey. Those people at the hospital aren't the only ones who matter." "They're sick, Len. You want me to tell them I'm sorry, but my husband needs his shirts ironed?" Or about my baseball. "It's too much, Len. He could make something of himself. Look at him. He's exhausted all the time." Sometimes, sitting on those steps, My sister would put her hands over her ears and cry. But I tried to listen. It was like sneaking into a grown-up world. I knew my father worked late, and in the last few years he'd gone on overnight trips to his liquor distributors, telling my mother, "Posey, if you don't schmooze these guys, they gut you like a fish." I knew that he was setting up another store in Collingswood, about an hour away, and he worked there a few days a week. I knew a new store would mean more money and a better car. I knew my mother didn't like the whole idea. So yes, they fought, but I never imagined consequences. Parents didn't split up back then. They worked it out. They stayed on the team. I remember a wedding we all went to when my father rented a tuxedo and my mother wore a shiny red dress. During the reception, they got up to dance. I saw my mother lift her right hand. I saw my father put his big mitt alongside it. And as young as I was, I could tell they were the best-looking people on the floor. My father cut a tall, athletic figure, and unlike other fathers, his belly was flat behind his rib-white shirt. And my mother? Well, she looked happy, smiling with her creamy red lipstick. And when she looked happy, everyone took a back seat. She was such a smooth dancer, you couldn't help but watch her, and her shiny dress seemed spotlighted as she moved. I heard some older women at the table mumbling, "It's a bit much," and "Show some modesty." But I could tell they were just jealous because they didn't look as pretty as she did. So that's how I saw my parents. They fought, but they danced. After my father disappeared, I would think about that wedding constantly. I would almost convince myself he was coming back to see my mother in that red dress. How could he not? But in time, I stopped thinking that. In time, I came to view that event the way you view a faded vacation photo. It's just someplace you went a long time ago. "What do you want to do this year?" my mother asked me the first September after they got divorced. School was about to start, and she was talking about new beginnings and new projects. My sister had chosen a puppet theater. I looked at my mother and made the first of a million scowling faces. "I want to play baseball," I said. A meal together. I don't know how much time passed in that kitchen. I still had a spinning, groggy feeling, like when you bang your head on the trunk of a car. But at some point, maybe when my mother said, "Eat," I physically surrendered to the idea of being there. I did what my mother told me. I put a forkful of eggs into my mouth. My tongue practically sprung to attention. I hadn't eaten in 2 days, and I began shoveling food like a prisoner. The chewing took my mind off the impossibility of my situation, and can I be honest? It was as delicious as it was familiar. I don't know what it is about food your mother makes for you, especially when it's something that anyone could make, pancakes, meatloaf, tuna salad, but it carries a certain taste of memory. My mother used to put chives in her scrambled eggs, the little green things I called them, and here they were again. So now I was eating a past tense breakfast at a past tense table with a past tense mother. "Slow down, don't make yourself sick," she said. That, too, was past tense. When I finished, she took the plates to the sink and ran water over them. "Thank you," I mumbled. She looked up. "Did you just say thank you, Charlie?" I barely nodded. "For what?" I cleared my throat. "For breakfast?" She smiled as she finished scrubbing. I watched her at the sink and had a sudden rush of familiarity. Me at this table, her at the dishes. We'd had so many conversations from just this position, about school, about my friends, about what gossip I shouldn't believe from the neighbors, always the rushing sink water causing us to raise our voices. "You can't be here," I began. Then I stopped. I couldn't get beyond that sentence. She shut the faucet and wiped her hands on a towel. "Look at the time," she said. "We have to get going." She leaned over and cupped my face. Her fingers were warm and damp from the sink water. "You're welcome," she said, "for breakfast." She grabbed her handbag from the chair. "Now be a good boy and get your coat on." A note, dated July 20th, 1959. "Dear Charlie, I know you are scared, but there's nothing to be scared about. We have all had our tonsils out, and look at us. We're okay. You hold on to this letter. Put it under your pillow before the doctors come in. They're going to give you something to make you sleepy, and just before you fall asleep, you can remember my letter is there and if you wake up before I get to your room, then you can reach under the pillow and read this again. Reading is like talking, so picture me talking to you there, and soon I will be. And then you can have all the ice cream you want. How about that? I love you every day. Mom. Chick's family after the divorce. For a while after my parents split up, we tried to stay the same, but the neighborhood wouldn't allow it. Small towns are like metronomes. With the slightest flick, the beat changes. People were nicer to my sister and me. There'd be an extra lollipop at the doctor's office or a larger scoop on the ice cream cone. Older women encountering us on the street would squeeze our shoulders earnestly and ask, "How are you kids doing?" which struck us as an adult question. The kids' version began with, "What?" But if we were showed more kindness, my mother was not. People didn't get divorced back then. I didn't know a single kid who had endured it. Splitting up, at least where we lived, meant something scandalous, and one of the parties would be assigned the blame. In our case, the blame fell on my mother, mostly because she was still around. Nobody knew what happened between Len and Posey, but Len was gone, and Posey was there to be judged. It didn't help that she refused to seek pity or to cry on their shoulders. To make matters worse, she was still young and pretty. So to women, she was a threat, to men, an opportunity, and to kids, an oddity. Not really great choices when you think about it. Over time, I noticed people looking at my mother differently when we pushed a cart through the local grocery store, or when in that first year after the divorce, she dropped my sister and me at school in her white nurse's outfit and her white shoes and white hose. She always got out to kiss us goodbye, and I was acutely aware of the other mothers staring. Roberta and I became self-conscious, approaching the school door as if we squeaked. "Give your mother a kiss," she said one day, leaning over. "Don't," I said, sliding away. "Don't what?" I scrunched my shoulders and winced. "Just don't." I couldn't look at her, so I looked at my feet. I heard her sniff. I felt her rub my hair. By the time I looked up, the car was pulling away. One afternoon, I was playing catch with a friend in the church parking lot when two nuns opened the back door. My friend and I froze, figuring we had done something wrong, but the nuns motioned me over. They each held an aluminum tray. As I approached, I could smell meatloaf and green beans. "Here," one of them said, "for your family." I couldn't understand why they were giving me food, but it wasn't like you said no thanks to a nun. So I took the trays and I walked them home, figuring my mother must have ordered them special. "What's that?" she asked when I entered the house. "The nuns gave it to me." She pulled back the wax paper. She sniffed. "Did you ask for this?" "Nah, I was playing catch." "You didn't ask for this?" "No." "Because we don't need food, Charlie. We don't need handouts, if that's what you think." I got defensive. I didn't really understand handout, but I could tell it meant something that didn't get handed out to everyone. "I didn't ask for it," I protested. "I don't even like green beans." We looked at each other. "It's not my fault," I said. She relieved me of the trays and dumped them in the sink. She mashed the meatloaf into the garbage disposal with a large spoon. She did the same with the green beans. She moved so feverishly, I couldn't take my eyes off of her, pounding all that food down that small round hole. She turned on the water. The disposal roared. When the sound pitched higher, meaning it was done, she removed the magnetized top. She shut off the water. She wiped her hands on the front of her apron. "So," she said, turning to me, "are you hungry?" The first time I heard the word divorcee was after an American Legion baseball game. The coaches were throwing bats in the back of a station wagon, and one of the fathers from the other team picked up my bat by mistake. I ran over and said, "That one's mine." "It is?" he said, rolling it in his palm. "Yeah, I brought it with me on my bike." He could have doubted that, since most kids came with their dads. "Okay," he said, handing it over. Then he squinted and said, "You're the divorcee's kid, right?" I looked back wordless. Divorcee? It sounded exotic, and I did not think of my mother that way. The men used to ask, "You're Len Bonetto's kid, right?" And I'm not sure which bothered me more, being the son of this new word, or no longer being the son of the old ones. "So how's your mom doing?" he asked. I shrugged. She's doing good. Yeah, he said. His eyes darted around the field, then back to me. She need any help around the house? I felt as if my mother were standing behind me, and I was the only thing between them. She's doing good, I said again. He nodded. If it's possible to distrust a nod, I did. Still, if that was the day divorcee became familiar, I remembered distinctly the day it became abhorrent. My mother had come home from work and sent me to the local market for some ketchup and rolls. I decided to take a shortcut through the backyards. When I came around the side of a brick ranch house, I saw two older kids from school huddled there, one of them, a beefy kid named Leon, shielding something against his chest. "Hey, Bonetto," he said quickly. "Hey, Leon," I said. I looked at the other kid. "Hey, Luke." "Hey, chick." "Where you going?" Leon said. "Finelli's," I said. "Yeah? Yeah." He released his grip. He was holding binoculars. "What are those for?" I said. He turned to face the trees. "Army gear," he said. "Binos." 20 times magnification," Luke said. "Let me see." He handed them over and I held them to my eyes. They were warm around the rims. I moved them up and down, catching blurry colors of the sky, then the pine trees, then my feet. "They use them in the war," Luke said, "to locate the enemy." "They're my dad's," Leon said. I hated hearing that word. I handed them back. "See ya," I said. Leon nodded. "See ya." I walked on, but my thoughts were uneasy. Something about how Leon had turned to the trees too quickly, you know? So I circled back behind the house and hid in the hedges. What I saw bothers me to this day. The two of them were huddled close now, no longer facing the trees, but facing the other way, toward my house, passing the binoculars. I followed the sight line to my mother's bedroom window. I saw her shadow move across the pane, her arms lifted over her head, and I immediately thought, home from work, changing her clothes, bedroom. I felt myself go cold. Something shot from my neck to my feet. "Ooh-wee," Leon cooed, "look at the divorcee." I don't think I ever felt fury like that, not before and not since. I ran to those boys with blood in my eyes, and even though they were bigger than me, I jumped them from behind and grabbed Leon by the neck and threw punches at anything that moved, anything at all.